From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Monday evening in Paris, when at about 7:50 p.m., the centuries-old spire of Notre Dame Cathedral collapsed in a massive fire. Two-thirds of Notre Dame's roof was destroyed, and many relics and pieces of artwork were damaged. Some were lost. Those pieces of history, as well as the cathedral itself, are symbols of cultural, religious, and national pride. They survived 8 centuries of wars, plague, even the French Revolution, and now people around the world are contemplating the enormity of the loss. The cathedral was undergoing restorations when the fire started. Investigators think it was an accident. A veteran expert overseeing Notre Dame's makeover said, quote, "For me, it's like losing a dear friend, like your grandparents have died. I think it's terrible. It's not just because of religion, but because it is such a grand part of our patrimony," end quote. News outlets around the world have reported on the fire, reactions to it, and what's next for Notre Dame. But some scholars say an important conversation is missing often from those reports. One of those scholars, Professor Catherine Clark Walter at the College of Brockport, wrote to us at Connections and said that U.S. reporting lacked an understanding of history and the cultural role of religion. She said, quote, "It is interesting that the major Gothic cathedrals of Europe were often born of renovations necessitated by devastating fires, just such as this one, and the renovations often foregrounded the relics these churches held as key to their spirituality and identity. So there is a fascinating meaning of past and present," end quote. And we've invited that professor to join us this hour to help us understand the history and cultural significance of what happened in Paris and what Notre Dame represents. And for those of us who may not be too familiar with the relics inside Notre Dame, like a crown of thorns, we'll discuss what they are and their place in history and culture, what we know about what was lost or preserved, and more. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Catherine Clark Walter is an associate professor in the Department of History at the College of Brockport. I'm really glad you reached out, and it's nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Jean Pedersen, who is an associate professor of history in the Humanities Department at the Eastman School. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Sarah Thompson is a professor of art history at RIT. Welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, I want to ask all three of you, if you could, for some initial thoughts. And then I think for me, I feel just as ignorant as just about anybody. I've seen Notre Dame in person, have never been inside it, and I know a lot of people were sort of communing by sharing their own personal stories, but for many of us, even though who did see it in person, it's probably we got the quick tour, we got a little bit of the architectural history, not the rich history that I think you're going to bring. And for our listeners, it will be a chance to either ask questions or kind of weigh in with your own thoughts on the matter. But let's go around the table, and I'll start with Professor Catherine Clark Walter. What do you think has been sort of missing from the conversation this week?
Well, I think that, Evan, what you say about having an impressionistic view of these major historical sites like Notre Dame is a very typical experience, and to know more does take some digging. I teach students at Brockport, and to them everything looks old, and if it's old, it's old. And so trying to sort out what those layers of history are actually takes the interest to dig into it. And I was hoping that this horrible event might have a silver lining of people understanding more how much history is layered on that site and what they are lamenting when they see the spire fall or when they know the church the way they know it, as opposed to how it has evolved on that site over many, many years.
Was it surreal for you to see it in real time?
I was transfixed. I saw a report on Facebook and instantly turned on the television and was horrified at how fast this disaster was unfolding.
Professor Pedersen, what do you think?
Well, so many different things, because I am a 19th century French historian, and so in my mind, I know that the spire that fell was itself a replacement that was put up in the 19th century before a different spire that was taken down because it wasn't sturdy enough to stand. But in my heart, I've traveled to Paris many times. I have friends there. My heart is broken. It is like a death in the family. And then this is, for Christians, this is Holy Week. And I am not a Catholic, but I am a Christian. We started with Palm Sunday. We're remembering the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so it is very dramatic to have this death of a building. And it challenges our faith to think about the rebirth of that building in this particular moment.
But we can feel at least some confidence that we know the building will be restored, reborn in some sense.
I was so grateful. You know, I heard the news by text message from a friend of mine, went to the nearest computer, which was in the science lobby of the University of Rochester, sat there weeping in public as I watched the flames, and I was so relieved to wake up the next day and see that those stone towers were still standing, you know, it made me feel the way Francis Scott Key felt when he wrote the national anthem, that there was catastrophe and then the flag was still there. For me, there was catastrophe and then the facade was still there. I can't tell you what a relief that is to me.
Professor, what do you think?
It was a very strange experience to watch this happen on social media, a kind of modern version of things that actually did happen in the Middle Ages. Many of the great cathedrals that we know are cathedrals that were, in fact, born out of great fires. The cathedral at Chartres is a great example of that. There was a massive fire in Chartres in 1194 that caused the almost complete destruction of the building that was standing there at the time. And we have chroniclers who talk about the experience of these fires and kind of what these fires mean. So to watch something like that, but then to kind of watch it on Twitter as people are commenting on it. Again, a very, very strange thing. I have to agree with Kat, though, as well, that there is a funny kind of contrast between having a personal experience with and a knowledge of a building and kind of knowing it as this comforting landmark in your life, but then also having a kind of scholarly understanding of a building as being a product of many centuries of experience and endurance.
Hmm. If I can jump in on
that, please.
This semester I've been working on some very specific images on the north facade of Notre Dame and learning things about the cathedral I didn't know and answering questions I didn't even know I was supposed to ask. And I couldn't wait until the next time I got back to Paris, whenever that would be, so I could walk around the cathedral and see it with different eyes. Because frequently, you know, when you see something as a tourist, you go to a place just once. But when you see a place as a scholar where you bring students back year after year or where your work is concerned with that space, you go back to it and you see it over layers of many years. And that's, I think, the kind of thing we try to convey to our students, is that one time at something doesn't tell you everything you need to know about it, whereas tourism kind of needs to tell us that, or else we wouldn't ever go on trips because it would be futile, right? So trying to know a space in its diversity and over time is a luxury of study and time that tourists don't often have.
We talked about, our guests have talked about seeing the spire come down, but also some of the structure remain, when for at least several hours it looked like very possibly the entire thing would be gone.
That was the worst.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about what's inside, because for so many of us, and you touched on this a little bit in your email, Professor, that there are relics and there's important parts of history, especially within Christianity. Let's talk a little bit about what's was inside the cathedral and what we know is sort of preserved, or at least what we're hearing so far.
Well, I was actually amazed when I saw some of the aftershots at the medieval builders, because those vaults are incredible. The vaults that stood between the interior of the cathedral and the roof that burned are amazing. And I show pictures of those to my students, and you can see pictures anytime, and skyscrapers and all of that. They're like, okay, so they're tall buildings, and they love to go into the cathedrals. But I don't think anyone, even me, appreciated how amazing those vaults were, because they stood between the roof caving in and ruining everything, and the things underneath them being safe. And so it appears that certain things had been already removed from the cathedral in the process of the renovation. And other things were preserved because they were under spaces where the vaults, which is the poured concrete and the arches, the stone arches that you see if you stand in the middle of a cathedral and you look up, you're looking at the vaults. And Sarah can speak to that much better than I can. But the things that were under those massive stone vaults actually were what some people are saying miraculously protected, including the organ, the crown of thorns relic, the tunic of Saint Louis, and other artworks. Because a cathedral is absolutely strewn with special niches, altars, areas where over centuries artists have been commissioned to place irreplaceable works of art. And so many, many more of those survived than anyone anticipated when we looked at the pictures on Monday night.
Yes. The relics of Notre Dame are actually kept in a treasury that is attached to the cathedral, so they are not actually underneath the main body of it. And those, as far as I know, were fairly easy to remove and to, you know, secure and keep safe. The vaults themselves did collapse in several places. They collapsed directly underneath the place where the spire fell. And they, from photographs I've seen anyway, there's also a kind of opening in the vault over one of the transept roses, which makes it even all the more amazing that the glass still seems to be in place and intact.
Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would also say that for anyone whose heart has ever lifted seeing the statues of the apostles on the roof, that they were all also removed as part of the renovation and are safe somewhere else. And I would be remiss coming from the Eastman School of Music if I didn't reassure everyone that the organ will be playable again.
One last place where there were relics, which I did not know until I started questioning reporters talking about this as they watched the spire fall, was there were relics that were medieval in origin, but not placed on the roof in any medieval time. There were relics in the rooster, which stood atop the spire that fell on Monday night. And I was wondering, you know, why would someone put them up there? And it turned out that a bishop in 1935, in a time of great turmoil and impending war in Europe, put them up on the top of the spire in the rooster. There were three relics, one spine from the crown of thorns, one piece of a saint, hair or teeth perhaps, from Saint-Denis, an important patron saint in France, and Saint-Geneviève, who's an important patron saint of Paris. And he put them up there as what he called a spiritual lightning rod. And you can find this documented in Catholic journals of the time, that this was an international thing, that people knew about this. It's not a very medieval thing to do. Medieval people tended to keep their relics in places where pilgrims could come and see it. It was a huge source of inspiration and also revenue in the Middle Ages. It was the tourism of the Middle Ages. So it's very interesting that this very pastoral-minded archbishop and cardinal, his name was Jean Verdier, put these relics up on top of the church as sort of a renewed yet medieval kind of testimony to faith and protection of Paris. And that rooster was thought to be burned, and it was found on Tuesday night. And there are absolutely jubilant pictures on French Twitter Tuesday night of curators finding the rooster, seeing that it's damaged. They're not sure if the relics are inside. I'm not sure if anybody totally wants to look, but we all want to know, did the relics make it? Are they still in there? Were they ever there to begin with?
And again, what's thought to be inside? Which relics are thought to be inside?
The relics of Saint-Denis, or Saint-Denis, Saint-Geneviève, and a spine from or thorn from the crown of thorns.
And can I just ask, as someone who is, again, very much ignorant of the history, a spine from the crown of thorns, how confident are we that this is an actual spine from the crown of thorns, or is this more symbolic?
Well, that is an amazing question. People in the Middle Ages themselves questioned whether relics such as professed pieces of the true cross or professed thorns from Christ's crown were actually authentic. And in the 12th century, one churchman quipped that if you had all of the pieces of the true cross put together, you would have a forest. Because he didn't believe they were all authentic. So the authenticity of relics is a perennial question. I think most of the faithful, and maybe Jean can say something about this as well, most of the faithful choose to believe they're authentic. There are certainly stories of miracles and miraculous events, healing events, wondrous events of protection and sustenance that happen around these miracles. And so that received tradition often seems to be more important to the faithful than whether the relics are actually provable to be authentic. And of course, that also, since the 12th century, has fueled an active, lively, cynical debate about the revenues that can be generated from such spiritual pieces.
Sure. Jean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say a couple of things about that authenticity question. One thing is, I think, and I don't know what a Roman Catholic would say, but what I would say as an Episcopalian is that those objects have acquired importance because so many people have believed in them for so long, and that their place as a focus of collective belief is important no matter where they came from. I'm thinking about our own, you know, in downtown Rochester, we have a Catholic church that was burnt out. One of the most moving stories I've read about that fire is the way, I believe it was a priest and a nun who ran back into the fire to rescue the consecrated host from the flames. The way a priest in Paris just a few days ago put on fire gear to show the firefighters where the relics were. And this shows people's devotion to those objects. And that, I think, is important regardless of where they came from.
Certainly from a medieval point of view, the authenticity of the relics would rely on their ability to generate faith and would also rely on miracles that could be associated with them. And from that point of view, the idea that the tip of the spire with these relics inside has miraculously survived this fire, you know, that this could be seen as a kind of miraculous survival that testifies to the authenticity of what is inside of it.
And even if you're not a believer, it's kind of a comforting human interest story that this adorable rooster in the arms of the curator who found it was good news after a week of very, very bad news. I would also say, before we're too cynical or hard on the medievals for being so invested in what seem to many people today rather bizarre or even grotesque items, such as the hair and teeth of a person who lived long ago, these were requirements for churches to be consecrated, that they had a piece of sacred object. And it also became part of the economy of the medieval church to generate interest, generate traffic and pilgrimages to their spaces. And relics were a huge draw. People took enormous satisfaction, pleasure, innovation, and delight at seeing a new place. Travel in the Middle Ages wasn't so easy, and pilgrimage was the main reason, along with trade and crusading, that people traveled. And so it was a huge part of medieval life, just as someone might be culturally Catholic or culturally Jewish today, even if they weren't particularly personally pious.
Hmm. You want to add to that, Jean?
Yeah, I would say also that reminds me that relics are not specific to Christianity, medieval or otherwise. I can remember being in Sri Lanka going to a temple where there is a tooth from the Buddha. It is said that if you look on that tooth when you are completely happy, you will have good luck all the rest of your life. You know, I think every major world religion has things that are touchstones for its faith.
Yeah, Chris Clemens, who writes the Exploring Upstate blog, says, if it helps for the discussion, we have regional collections that more should know of. One of the largest collections of relics in the world is in Western New York at Cheektowaga, which I was not aware of. So there's a lot of history around us. And, you know, even as someone who I try never to be cynical, I try to be proudly skeptical. I do find a beauty in these painful moments that, you know, when the rooster survives. And if people want to attach meaning to that, the cynical thing to do would be to say, well, that's confirmation bias. But the beautiful thing to say is we all need a moment of hope in a difficult moment like we have this week. And there is going to be a chance to rebuild. I don't know if you could ever rebuild it the same way. In some ways, it reminded me of being in Barcelona a year ago in the Sagrada Familia. And of course, Gaudí gets hit by a streetcar and dies before he can complete the Sagrada Familia. But at least the plans were there until the Spanish Civil War, and then the plans are gone. And the interesting thing to me, being at the Sagrada Familia, was seeing the decision they made on how to rebuild. So let me ask you about what you think is going to happen next. What was explained to me, and again, this is a very lay understanding, but what was explained to me in Barcelona was, without the actual plans from Gaudí, you could find the best artists in the world to try to approximate. But that would be a little bit like telling someone, you know, here's Mozart's symphony and, you know, you finish it. Well, good luck. So what they instead did was they took other great artists who have very different styles. And when you're at the Sagrada Familia, it's very clear where the departure from Gaudí has happened. And they're okay with that. I mean, that's been controversial, but the idea being that you can't get back inside Gaudí's head. If the plans are gone, they're gone. I don't know what's going to happen at Notre Dame, because I don't even really have all of the history and you know, the decades that were required to finish it in the first place and really who was behind it. But I want to ask all of you what you expect to see. Sarah, I'll start with you.
What I expect to see is probably going to be a rather quick jump to try to reconstruct as much as possible. The difficulty there is that some of the materials that they would need to try to create, say, a replica of the lost roof of Notre Dame are now impossible to find. The rafters at Notre Dame were made of old growth oak, you know, medieval forests, basically, that go into the construction of a roof like that. We do not have that kind of wood accessible anymore. We do not have those old growth forests that we can use to, you know, harvest to make these kinds of rafters again. I'm not necessarily sure how much that matters. This is not a part of the building that most people would ever actually see with their own eyes. It may be more significant to create simply a roof that is functional and that can keep the interior of the building safe and secure, and that is a complement to the outside of the building from the roof surface. But it will be a very difficult kind of quest. There are really different ideas about what restoration actually means, and you have a side that would argue for the kind of replication of what was there before, that we need to restore the building back to exactly what it was. You have the idea that you need to, in restoration, show instead that there is a change or a difference between what exists and what we have replaced. You have people who say, well, we need to do something that is, you know, a product of our time that will add to the layers of this building. And you have a kind of 19th century Viollet-le-Duc idea of restoration, which is we should bring the cathedral to a state that is a perfect ideal state, but that never may have actually existed in real life.
Hmm. And that was the case with the spire that Eugene Viollet-le-Duc designed, that everyone is really associates as the icon of Notre Dame along with its towers. And he freely admitted that he didn't think that it looked like the medieval spire. And he thought that creating a unity of a perfection of his idea of the Gothic architecture of the 13th and 14th or 12th and 13th centuries was more important than absolute historical accuracy. Whereas I think today, at least among scholars, you know, the pedantic details might matter more than the emotional details.
Okay, Jean?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do not know what to expect, but I know what I hope for, speaking of emotional details. I hope that there will be a spire. I hope that it will be stunningly beautiful and that hearts will lift up when they see it. I hope that the apostles will return to the roof so that I can see them again and everyone can see them again as they've been silhouetted against the sky for so many years. And I think about, as a 19th century historian, I think about the city hall of Paris, the Hôtel de Ville, a different center of lively life, especially when World Cup soccer is on and people are outside jamming it to watch on a giant big screen TV. That was burned in 1870. As part of the Franco-Prussian War and the Paris Commune. And it has been reconstructed to a state of such beauty that when I first saw it 30 years ago and the person I was with told me it was a reconstruction, I flat out did not believe them. And then it turned out I've seen the photos of the hollow shell in far worse shape than Notre Dame. So I know that buildings can come back. And whether it will be exactly what was before, whether it will just look exactly like what was before but made out of something different, whether it will look different from what was before, what I hope most is that it will still look beautiful and that it will still inspire.
Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Do you want to add to what we've... It looked like you wanted to jump in there, Sarah.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'll think for a moment.
A profound conversation with people. So this panel is far more expert than so much of what we've heard reported. And I really appreciate what we're hearing this hour in terms of the history, the understanding of what has happened there. And frankly, I think some of the comfort that comes from knowing that this is not the first time. I mean, that's not to downplay it, but... You know,
well,
we've seen this.
Yeah, it's certainly not the first time that Notre Dame has undergone some significant destruction or kind of challenge to its existence. And this is also a building for which we do have extensive documentation, not just photographic documentation. I mean, this is probably one of the most photographed monuments in existence. But we also have significant digital documentation. And Professor Andrew Tallon of Vassar has been in the news recently. Unfortunately, he passed away in early November of last year. But it had been his life's work to create laser scans of these kinds of great buildings. And he had been significantly involved at Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm. What I also hope that comes out of this is some new thoughts about historic preservation, because I know that I was absolutely shocked that something that's existed my whole lifetime could change so rapidly in front of my eyes on the television. And I, you know, teach historic preservation and public history and museum studies at Brockport. So, you know, sort of dislodging this sense that just because things seem constant for us, they do need our constant vigilance, and they compete for resources with other very needed things, other human interests. So trying to find some way to come up with better safeguards for our cultural heritage sites, and not just ours, but around the world, realizing the importance of preserving them, maintaining them, and, you know, not having them be an accident of carelessness, such as what happened at Notre Dame, in the sense that those restorations were very needed.
Just to add to that, I mean, Notre Dame was under restoration at the time that this fire broke out, as you mentioned in the introduction, and it had been in desperate need of conservation for many, many years. And buildings like this are constantly underfunded. And the people who work on them are constantly having to deal with a kind of triage state where they need to direct any kind of funding they get to the most immediate needed repairs to keep a building operational. And so often things like fire safety preventions are not the things that you necessarily need right now today to keep the building operational. So they're not really able to be proactive about issues of, say, access or safety when they don't have the funding to do so.
I do wonder what confession is going to be like for the construction worker who accidentally started this fire.
Well, I suppose it will depend on whether or not he or she believes in confession. but I will say that, you know, confession and forgiveness, confession is perhaps the hardest thing to do, and then forgiveness is the hardest thing to receive and believe.
Well, I said that rather cheekily, but at the same time, I do think, particularly depending on where your faith lies, but hopefully for all of us, that forgiveness is possible. And I do hope that there is some path forward for whoever might have sparked this. Though I'm sure there will be a long investigation, and that will be very difficult. I mean, Cubs fans didn't do very well forgiving Steve Bartman for a long time for catching a foul ball. I don't know how the French or the world will do with the person who accidentally burned at Notre Dame, but I certainly hope so. And that really is a part of the core of the themes of the week that we're in, isn't it, Jean?
Confession, repentance, forgiveness, belief that every death is the first step in a new life, that can be very hard to believe sometimes. But I do believe that that is always true, and I believe that will be true here for the person, for the building, for the community of faithful around the world, and for the community of lovers of Notre Dame around the world, which is a far bigger community than that.
I'm going to get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls. And we're talking about what happened at Notre Dame, what happens not only next, but the history that should guide our way of understanding what has happened this week, watching that tragic fire at the cathedral. You just heard Jean Pedersen, who's an associate professor of history in the humanities department at the Eastman School, Sarah Thompson, associate professor of art history at RIT, and Catherine Clark Walter, associate professor in the Department of History at the College at Brockport. We're going to come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the authors of the new book, Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin are traveling the country, and their tour concludes in Rochester today. They literally hold events where they ask people to turn in their guns so they can beat those guns into garden tools. They melt them down and turn them into common garden objects. We'll talk about their work next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to your phone calls, and we're going to start with Kate in Rochester. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Evan. I have heard a lot of metaphors about the cathedral all week, and I know you're more talking about physical restoration, but and I've heard metaphors about beauty going up in flames, and but the one that comes to mind for me is, and I haven't heard this, is a purification from the sexual abuse scandal. And I just wondered if you had thoughts on that, and I'll take the response off the air.
Thank you, Kate. I certainly had. I mean, there's been a lot of different directions that people around the world have taken their thoughts in responding to this. I don't know if our guests have any thoughts on that particular direction.
I could say something.
Sure, go ahead, Jean.
About that. I would say, first of all, any symbol, if it has power, will mean different things to different people. And that means that its preservation or destruction will mean different things to different people. And obviously, for some people, communities of faith have been life-giving. And for other people, those same communities of faith have been deeply destructive. And it's hard to hold those realities at the same time. I think some of your question goes directly to the question of how we think about God, whether we believe that God is a God that takes vengeance and that acts destructively, or whether we believe that God is a God who is infinitely loving and ready to forgive. And I will say, when it comes to sexual abuse of anyone by anyone, secular or clergy, child or adult, that pushes the limits of my ability to forgive, for sure. I feel the only thing I know about God is that God is bigger than I am and may have capacities that I do not have. But at the same time, if I had been hurt, would I want to know that God was on my side and ready to defend with all his divine wrath? Probably I would.
Yeah.
I would add that that sentiment of trying to make sense of why something happened, to assign blame for something that isn't directly related to this church, although there certainly may not be, Notre Dame as a parish may not be immune from the scandal at all, but trying to assign meaning out of these different events that become linked in our minds is a very historical thing to do. If you look at the medieval sources that talk about why bad things happen, including destruction to churches and cathedrals, it is often perceived as some kind of sinful behavior. In the works I read, it's usually churchmen writing about how the laity were sinful or how other clergy were not sufficiently pious. But that sense of divine retribution, you know, a kind of a form of miracle coming down to cleanse what human beings cannot take care of themselves, is a very old historical pattern. And it doesn't surprise me that these same patterns occur to us today, even as ironically we tend to think of ourselves as progressed beyond the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages were not the only time that people thought about things like vengeance and persecution and retribution, as we can tell.
Yeah, and my personal bias steers me away from this. I mean, I find, and not to discount or disrespect what Kate said, and I appreciate that phone call, but this recalls to me the echoes. I mean, it was David K. Johnston, journalist, jumped on Twitter 3 hours after the fire and said, how long until Pat Robertson blames this fire on, you know, some persecuted class that he thinks God doesn't like in the same way that he did with Hurricane Katrina?
Sometimes can I just say, let us not give Pat Robertson any extra ideas.
Fair. Fair, Jean. Very fair. Sometimes the answer is luck or happenstance.
I believe some commentators did say that this is a testimony, if not a cause, or, you know, not a product, but a testimony to the fallen state of Christianity today. So people, I think, were very quick to assign a moral meaning to what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There certainly have been commentators who have been trying to associate this with, say, some sort of a threat to Western civilization, however they define this. And it has been, I would say, pretty disappointing to read those things and to see them picked up and carried on.
Absolutely.
All right, let me turn to Charlie in Seneca Falls next on the phone. Go ahead, Charlie.
Multiple points I'd like to make. First of all, my partner for the last 15 years is a French woman. I spend a lot of time in France and Paris. Vero's sister and her brother-in-law are both very serious conservators, restorers. If you look at the Pietà that you see in the images to the right of the altar, Natalie was the last one to do work on that Pietà. So I don't have the skills, but I have a lot of conversation with these folks. So that's my background here. The cathedral in Chartres burned some years ago. You wouldn't know it to look at it. The roof is all now a very modern steel-framed construction underneath, but the outside looks exactly like what it used to look like. My guess is there will be a similar kind of action on the roof, and this is just a guess, but I am an engineer. The practical answer is don't do it with timbers. If there's an urge to do it with timbers, the oak forests of France are immense and vast. If you drive through Burgundy, and especially the Morvan, you will find miles and miles of oak forest. And each commune, each village in France has their own forêt communale. So if Seneca Falls were in France, there would be the forest for Seneca Falls. Some of the mayors have already said, we have all the trees you need if you want to harvest. So I don't think they'll go for timber, but if they do, the timber's there. The key point, though, all of the skills for the restoration, whatever kind of restoration there will be, exist in France now. France has been actively doing this since, well, the time of the last spire being put on the church. The stonemasons, the timber framers, the roof people are all there. And so when they finally decide what they're going to do, it will happen. First concern is the north wall of the transept. It's totally freestanding right now. That has to be braced, and they're probably working that issue as we speak about it. It will be very interesting. Will it get done in 5 years? Don't know. Hard to tell. Yeah. But it will get done, and when we're all done, we'll say, oh, my God, what a marvelous job they've done.
Charlie, thank you. Yeah, thank you for the phone call, Charlie. Some thoughts from our guests on that?
I think actually the first thing that they need to do, I mean, they certainly do need to brace the freestanding transept wall. They're going to need to cover the vaults And you do not want to have water pooling on the tops of the vaults. You don't want to have them exposed to weather. They are made of limestone. They are not intended to actually be exposed to continuous weather or to continuous additional weight pressing on the top. And it may actually be a pretty technically challenging feat to get them covered. I mean, I'm certain that they will be able to do so, but they need to come up with some sort of a temporary way to secure the top of the building.
Okay.
I would also imagine that doing a finer survey of the damage and to look at the surface of the stone, because the stone is standing and we're very grateful, but the surface can be damaged very easily. And once the surface is breached, then the stone loses its durability. And so this is going to be a long process. And the concern might be to rush to have it done in time for the upcoming Olympics or to have it done within a certain publicly sanctioned span of time. But it's going to need to be, and as our caller indicated, there are certainly people who can influence this process and who can add their amazing expertise to it. But it's going to need a thorough review before they can make next steps.
Its status as such an important monument for tourists, I mean, everyone who goes to Paris goes to Notre Dame. Everyone knows Notre Dame. And that is both a good and bad thing. You know, everyone loves Notre Dame. There's this outpouring of support for its reconstruction. On the other hand, there is, I think, some pressure there to get it back up and running because it is such a visited space and because it is so symbolic of the city of Paris.
Well, before we go back to the phone, I want to ask both Professor Pedersen and Professor Thompson about this because, you know, Sarah, you said during the break, the actual structure of Notre Dame is something we should probably talk a little bit more about here. And are you concerned going forward that the urgency is going to create some sort of compromise?
I'm more concerned that the urgency would cause the restoration to be maybe poorly thought through. But I don't think that that urgency going forward is going to be allowed to damage the structure of the building. I think that we still have a little bit of waiting to do to see what the state of the structure of the building actually is. Notre Dame, like many, many cathedrals, is a building composed almost entirely of limestone. Limestone has great compressive strength. It does not have great tensile strength. And when it is exposed to high heat for extended periods of time, that can structurally weaken the limestone. People don't think about stone burning, and I mean, it doesn't literally light on fire. But that extended heat can weaken the stone. It can cause it to crack. If it's exposed to heat for too long, it's going to turn into calcium oxide. So you want to make sure that you kind of give the building time to settle and that you are watching it, supporting it as it settles and kind of making sure that the structure is not substantially compromised in any way.
You want to jump in there?
No, just I think that's absolutely right, that what we see might not necessarily be what is going on.
Mm-hmm. And Jean, during our break, you talked about sort of just the vast size of this to begin with, that it's sort of a reminder to us just the scale of Notre Dame, not just in the meaning in our minds and in our culture, but also the physical scale of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's kind of like the joke about the Golden Gate Bridge, that you start painting it with rust-proof paint at one end and you work your way all the way to the other end. By the time you get to that end, you have to go back to the first end and start painting again. The Cathedral of John the Divine in New York City, where I grew up, has been under construction for so long that at some point the very scaffolding itself was hurting the building because of the bolts that were holding the steel to the stone. And that suffered a fire and has been subsequently rebuilt. Notre Dame is actually so big that the latest news I read this morning is that the Archbishop of Paris has already taken negotiations with the president of France to build a temporary church in the plaza in front of the church, which gives you a sense of how big it is, that its plaza itself is big enough to hold another building in front of it, precisely because of what Sarah was talking about, their desire to be able to welcome believers and tourists and visitors of all kinds from around the world, even while the stone building is not available for that purpose.
Hmm. And I would just add that in the 1600s and 1700s, when the church was in disrepair, a renovation or alterations to the church were carried out that were later considered absolutely horrible. They took the stained glass we've been so worried about in this fire, they took it out and replaced it with clear glass. And they changed the order of many of the interior arrangements. And part of the 19th century renovations was a absolute recoiling in horror at how people had let the church get into this state. And it sounded a lot like what we're saying right now, and that is the context of Victor Hugo's Paris and mm-hmm. Hunchback of Notre Dame. And in fact, that novel, as Jean knows much better than I do, encouraged the renovation, the 19th century renovation of Notre Dame.
There's a lot of people thumbing back through that novel this mm-hmm. week, aren't there?
It's the top
sure
of Amazon's list. Yes.
Is it really?
Yeah. Yes.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was wondering why they don't have a fire watchman that walks around and makes sure that there aren't any fires burning during the night, every night. But as far as the fire is concerned, it doesn't seem that anybody has said anything about having the fire watch with the welders. I mean, that's why we lost the merry-go-round at Seabreeze.
Yeah,
buildings because it didn't have the fire watch with the welders.
Yeah, Tom, let me just jump in and say I have no idea, and maybe our guests can share a little bit. If when you're doing welding work, I'm sure that they had some idea for precaution. I think we have to accept that we may not ever really know what caused this. I think Sarah, you were kind of saying during the break.
Well, it may be just very difficult for them to, say, locate it to a specific person's actions.
Yeah.
More likely, it's going to be associated with equipment or some kind of electrical failure or some kind of chemical failure. In terms of safeguards for fire at Notre Dame, they did have fire sensors throughout the roof structure. They did have a kind of a piping system that is not constantly running water, but that exists so that water can be piped up there if they need to. Be fighting a fire. But as a historic building, they just had not either dedicated the funds to or kind of been able to incorporate a significant fire safety system that would, say, include sprinklers or something like that without compromising the historical fabric of the building. And also just in terms of budget and money and kind of where do you put your money when you're trying to keep a building operational?
Jean?
Yeah, I would also say that this is where scale comes in, that in the time it would take you to walk from one end of the building to the other through the vaults, a fire could easily start behind you in a place that you'd just been in, and you wouldn't see it until you came around again. But also, I think it may not have been anything that any single person did. It might have been spontaneous combustion of volatile chemicals. It might have been, I'm no fire expert, but I have a friend whose apartment burned down once because the light was on in the linen closet, and that was enough for the terry towel 2 inches away to go up in flames and the whole thing to come down.
There were reports, too, that they detected the fire at about 6:20 and found nothing, and by 6:40 they had found it. And it's interesting that on both ends of this fire, there was a window of about 15 minutes to a half an hour when it started. Mm-hmm. And then I read, I'm not sure if this is accurate, but if it's true, that it was 15 to 30 minutes away from breaching the towers and causing the entire facade to crumble. And fortunately, the firefighters were able to stop the fire before that happened.
All right. Let me go back to a different Tom. This is Tom in Greece next. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm glad I was going to be able to get in this
sure.
late. Okay, I hope that the cathedral can be restored to its previous magnificence and grandeur and everything. I know it is important religious, cultural symbol, not only the people of France, but the people of the world. But just days before the fire in Paris, there were at least two black churches in Louisiana that were deliberately burned to the ground, and churches attended by black people. And by the racist the man who set the fires was arrested, and I was wondering if there's any how much concern there is for the again there should be concern for the Cathedral of Notre Dame, but I mean I was wondering how many if there's an effort to donate money to these black congregations in Louisiana so that they can have their churches back or new churches built.
Yeah, Tom, I'm glad you called. So a couple things. Let me first of all just read from the New York Times on what Tom is talking about if you haven't heard this news story here. Quote, three historically black churches have burned in less than 2 weeks in one South Louisiana parish where officials said they had found suspicious elements in each case. The officials have not ruled out the possibility of arson or the possibility that the fires are related. The three fires occurred on March 26th, April 2nd, and April 4th in St. Landry Parish, north of Lafayette. A fourth fire, a small blaze that officials said was intentionally set, was reported at a predominantly white church in Caddo Parish, about a 3-hour drive north. So a couple of things, Tom. I've already heard that there are efforts to direct some of the help to these churches, to these parishes in Louisiana that are suffering, for sure. And my guess is if you Google it, you can find it. And I'm glad to hear that, because the world is pouring a lot of effort in. French billionaires who are going to get outsized credit after probably not paying very much in the way of taxation, and then writing big checks and then demanding even less in the way of taxation, are going to get a lot of credit as well. But the point is, there will be the funds for Notre Dame. And I think there are efforts as well for these churches in the South. Why haven't they been reported on as much? They have been reported on. There's probably two reasons. I'm sure race plays a part, but also just in terms of the world scale, they don't have the imprint on the world scale that Notre Dame does. Now, you can argue that churches that get the world scale tend to be Eurocentric. That's a separate conversation, and it's a fair question to raise. But I'm really glad you called, Tom. Thank you for that. Because, you know, this has been a hard week for Houses of God, I would say. Jean, you want to?
Yes, I'm thinking about the conversation I had with my students at the University of Rochester in modern France the other day, and one of them pointed out that also an important religious building in the Middle East had burned down this week. And we talked about the selective attention that people have for different places. And one of the things I think is sad is that the people places that are the best known then become the most known. So it's like there's an unequal race from the get-go about what gets our attention. But at the same time, I would also say there are human connections and there are abstract connections. I feel a human connection to Notre Dame because I've been there. I feel an abstract connection to churches in Louisiana because I've never seen them. I feel a civic obligation to end racism in this country to the best that it is in our power to do. But it doesn't keep me from also having an emotional connection to a country that I've been visiting for 30 years.
Okay. Yeah.
There has also been a report that the attention to the fire at Notre Dame did shine a light on these events here at home and has increased the contributions to the GoFundMe page, which is a fortunate byproduct of a very unfortunate event.
Yes, I believe that as of last night, they had raised about $1 million for the churches in Louisiana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I suspect you'll see that total continue to climb. And if you're so inclined, Tom, you can find the GoFundMe page. It's probably pretty easy to find. And thank you for that phone call. In our last couple of minutes, I just want to ask our guest to kind of put some final points on a story that is going to be with us for a long time. What do you want us to keep in mind going forward, Professor Catherine Clark Walter, as we look at what happens at Notre Dame?
Well, springing off of this question of other concerns, other humanitarian concerns, I think the bigger takeaway from Notre Dame is our understanding of what is fragile and what is irreplaceable. And Notre Dame is both of those things. And I hope that it shines a light on other things in our cultural heritage, in our world, like our environment and our fellow human beings, to show that the things that we take for granted are often more fragile than we realize, and that we can give to Notre Dame or send our good wishes that way. And also let it teach us something about protecting our history, but also protecting each other and taking care of everyone.
Okay. Sarah?
Just to be inspired by the kind of beautiful writing of Victor Hugo in Notre Dame de Paris, when he is talking about the building as being this product of time. And I hope that we can look at it in that sort of perspective, to think about it as a product of just accumulated experiences that have existed over centuries and that will continue to exist.
Do you go back and read that and find any sense of, is it eerie to read some of those words given what's happened this week?
No, but that's because I teach a Gothic Revival class and we read that chapter every year.
For those of us revisiting or reading it for the first time, it will probably have a profound impact. Jean?
Yeah, I would say that my Facebook feed has been a national and international outcry of French historian wails of grief, people posting their photos and videos of the last time they were there, and then people posting photos of devastated cathedrals as a result of war and civil war next to the photos of their glorious reconstruction. I would give thanks that this was an accident and not an act of war or terrorism, but simply an accident, and that nobody was hurt, that there were 400 firefighters on hand who were able to contain that blaze, and that we are all still here to look forward to what happens next.
to make sure I understand the history as we close the hour, understanding what has happened at Notre Dame. There had been fire in the past there, but only is it only in the 13th century? Have we seen any other major events at Notre Dame itself?
There was not actually a fire in the 13th century. The cathedral, kind of as we know it today, was started in 1163 by the Bishop of Paris. The altar was consecrated in 1182. But there had been continual renovations over the years. They changed the elevation of the cathedral. It was attacked during the French Revolution. There's this famous incident where the statues of kings from the King's Gallery are taken down from the cathedral and are symbolically decapitated in front of the cathedral. And just the weathering of time caused the building to, you know, emerge in a state of disrepair that Victor Hugo at the beginning of the 19th century just found lamentable enough to write about.
Will this stand to be the most major renovation then, given everything that's happened there since 1163?
I would say that Villers-le-Duc in the 19th century was probably the more major renovation.
Even with this, so a good historical reminder for those who think something was permanently lost. Be interesting to see what happens next. And I want to thank our guests for their expertise and their time this hour. You just heard Professor Sarah Thompson from RIT. Thank you for being here. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to Professor Jean Pedersen, Professor of History in the Humanities Department at the Eastman School. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Catherine Clark Walter, Professor Walter from the Department of History at the College of Brockport. Thanks for reaching out and bringing your expertise here. Our listeners appreciate it, so do I. Thank you.
My pleasure, Evan.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.